Hey, this is actress Carissa Lee Staples, and you're listening to the O Brother Podcast.
Welcome to the O Brother Podcast with hosts Dan and Mike Smith, brothers from the same mother with different opinions on movies, TV, video games, and more, plus celebrity interviews. Get ready, get set, it's time for the O Brother Podcast. Welcome to the O Brother Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Smith. Alongside me, as always, my brother from the same mother, Ike Smith.
I've been waiting for this one, Dan.
Yeah, man. It's the O Brother Oppenheimer episode finally coming to you. You know, who would have thunk we did an episode on Barbie first?
Barbie is still number one, 4 weeks.
It's smashing records. I mean, Greta Gerwig now she's set records. She passed the director of Frozen 2.
Yeah.
Be the highest grossing female director of all time. All right, so this is not a Barbie episode. This is the Oppenheimer episode, as I
which
said.
Which is closely associated, right?
It is.
It came out the same day.
That's right. There was this whole Barbenheimer hype and whatever. So let's set this up a little bit. So this came out July 21st. So we're a little bit
late,
which was close to the anniversary of what is the focal point of this film, which is the first testing of the atomic bomb.
Right.
And of course, so this is following J. Robert Oppenheimer, who of course was played by Cillian Murphy, who just was spectacular.
Killer.
It was killer Killian.
Yeah.
Now you got a runtime, not a shock for any Christopher Nolan fans who of course wrote and directed this. He comes in at 3 hours. Again, not a surprise. I'm going to comment on that later on.
Okay. 301 to be perfectly exact.
Not according to IMDb. 3 hours exactly.
Yeah. Mine came up 301.
They round down. All right. So, just focus on the Trinity test that took place in Los Alamos, New Mexico. I have something to share with you. Is we know it was filmed in IMAX,
right?
And not certainly not Nolan's.
He always films in IMAX.
Exactly. I saw the film in IMAX.
Oh, you didn't tell me that.
Which I didn't tell you. Now I had tickets to see it in the regular theater. Last minute switcho changeo. My girlfriend actually makes the suggestion or it brings up IMAX. So you know me, I quickly, IMAX? Okay, let's do IMAX.
I'm jealous.
I think the last film I saw in IMAX was Pacific Rim with you, I think, up in New England.
Wow.
You remember
that? You know the screen I'm talking about. That screen is 10 stories.
Yeah. And this is, this is IMAX.
4K.
This is a huge, but it was nothing to write home about in terms of an IMAX experience. Now, I have to, real quick, we saw some trailers, we've done first looks on all these movies, Dune 2 and all of this stuff. Dune 2, I was more excited about it seeing the trailer in IMAX.
Interesting.
All right. So again, this is an Oppenheimer number.
Right.
So keep me on track here. But so we have a budget of about 100 million estimated somewhere in there. It opened at about 82 million.
Mm-hmm.
It's grossed as of this recording 264 and some change million bucks, right?
Right. Six.
And worldwide, about almost 650.
If you remember when we did Barbie, I said the thing about Barbie and Oppenheimer is the domestic release, I don't know why I said domestic.
Domestic, yeah.
But the domestic release in the...
It was just the emphasis on the dough.
It was tracking the same as the international release. Well, that's changed. Both movies now have higher grosses internationally than domestically. And Oppenheimer came in fourth last week behind Turtles and Meg 2. This week, back to number two. Now, very rarely does a movie drop
and go back up. Yeah. I'm
glad
you point that out because, with so much of the Barbenheimer hype, it's almost like, I think it was unfair to expect or assume that this was going to go toe-to-toe with it in terms of box office. They're two different films.
Right.
I'm not surprised that there's a much broader audience being drawn to Barbie. I mean, I get it.
Right.
But what Oppenheimer has done, these numbers, is nothing to sneeze at.
No, this is R-rated movie.
Right.
doing numbers that no other R-rated movie has done.
No, and again, I would, if you haven't seen it yet, I'd recommend you see it in IMAX if you can. And spoiler alert, because we're gonna take a dive into the film. Let me quickly run down some of the top cast.
Really, not a spoiler alert, given the fact that this is historic. This is a history.
No, but just in terms of, you know, the way it plays out in the film, or Nolan's interpretation of it, or whatever. But you're right; it's based in history. So, okay. So we mentioned Cillian Murphy, of course, plays Oppenheimer. It's amazing. Emily Blunt plays his wife Kitty in the film. Matt Damon plays General Groves.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Downey Jr. plays Louis Strauss.
Huge part.
Yeah, maybe too big. We'll get to that. Kenneth Branagh. Big fans of him. Mm-hmm. He played Niels Bohr, I believe is he was another physicist in that world.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Tom Conti, who played Einstein, who I thought was very good. There's many others. And then Florence Pugh, who played Jean.
You're not going to bring up Solo?
I am. I'm getting to
that. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm getting to that. And then Florence Pugh.
Didn't know him.
Oh, immediately. So, I was so excited to see Alden Ehrenreich. He plays like an aide to Robert Downey Jr.'s character.
Strauss. Right?
And Robert Downey Jr. is basically trying to vie for a seat on the president's cabinet is what this is all about. But Alden Ehrenreich, who honestly, I don't think I've really seen him since Solo, A Star Wars Story, not to indicate that he hasn't been working,
right?
But just really haven't seen him in a big hype film. And I was glad because you and I, as we've mentioned before in the podcast, have maybe the one and only episode out there in podcast world about why you should love Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Yep.
And a big part of that for us was his performance. And he got really dogged about it, you know?
Yeah. I remember reading they had to send him to acting classes.
Yes.
And I mean, he nailed it. He nailed it. Ron Howard, who came in and saved that film. His direction is fantastic.
It is. It's great. Yeah, it is. So you should check that one out too. But so I was excited to see him, and he had a pretty significant part throughout
the
film.
Pretty big part. I didn't know it was him till after the film. I had to go to the...
Really?
I had to look it up. I stayed for the credits, but I missed his name.
Yeah, there's some others. You know, since we're talking about it, I just want to mention... Scott Grimes, did you recognize him? He was the general counsel for Robert Downey Jr., the other kid that was sort of, it was either Alden Ehrenreich or Scott Grimes was on the other side. Did you recognize him at all?
No, I didn't.
He's been around for a long time. I knew him. He's from Lowell, Massachusetts.
Ah.
He's a local
boy.
Local boy, yeah. And he was in, I was trying to figure it out, and after the fact, we looked him up. And he was in Party of Five, which I used to watch.
I've never seen it.
And that's where I kind of burned in my brain. But he did a nice job.
But I do know his name.
Yeah. Matthew Modine. You know, I miss seeing Matthew Modine. I feel like he's an underrated actor.
Especially, what was the movie he did with Michelle Pfeiffer? He played Mike Smith.
Oh, did he really?
And I used to get ribbed about that all the time. He made up the name when he met Michelle, because he was supposed to be spying on her. And instead, he kind of like hit it off with her, and he called himself Mike Smith, which was a fake name for him.
Oh, so I don't think I saw that one.
Yeah.
You know, this is the one that blew me away, and I couldn't get it again until after the movie was over. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, I know this guy. Josh Hartnett.
Right.
And a huge part in the film.
Right, right.
Looks great.
Yes, different.
But looks different.
And I'll tell you, the killer.
Yeah,
that's how he normally looks.
He did a fantastic job. Really
what
good.
About... The best cameo of cameos was Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman was...
He was Truman.
He was
freaking Truman. It was only a minute of film.
I know. I intentionally didn't say anything to her until after, and I leaned over and said, did you recognize it? Because she loves Gary Oldman, Dracula, and all that. And didn't know it. But yeah, what a spectacular... Of course, I knew immediately who it was. But
I did too. But you know, the voice, the makeup...
accent was incredible.
It was perfect.
It was incredible, yeah.
And Truman was a salty character. And in the 1 minute he was on film, he captured Truman like I've never seen.
Now, I know
there's been movies made about
Truman. I know
Truman.
I'm going to get his name wrong. And I know Johnny Durango, who we love on the show, is friends with this gentleman, but he's been in the Dark Knight. You know, he's in the Nolan.
I know who you're talking about. He played like he had a small part.
He was in Suicide Squad with the like the dot.
That's right, the dot guy. Yes,
right.
That's right.
It's David Das Malchian. I'm sure I'm butchering David's name. But right. Anyways, he was great in this as well, and very recognizable.
Right. As soon as I saw him, because Christopher Nolan works with the same actors.
Yeah, but David's a Chicago guy like Johnny, so you know the connection there.
Yeah.
So anyways, I think that covers most of them. Now, I got to say, do you want to, I mean, like you said earlier, do we need to give a synopsis of the film or anything?
I don't think so. The only thing I would say is there was more to the relationship with Einstein than he portrayed in the film. That was about the only thing he got wrong, I thought.
And you know what he could have, you know what he could have done? He could have, it's 3 hours long. There is a good 20 minutes that could have been cut, perhaps used in a different manner. Like you're saying, maybe bring up the Einstein relationship a little bit more. Florence Pugh didn't serve the story whatsoever. Now, I get that this is a real character in his life. This is a real person that it was the daughter of one of the professors, I think, at Berkeley that Oppenheimer took up with.
Right.
But I just felt like it was primarily gratuitous, all the scenes. Like, you're always squawking about that on the podcast.
I am.
I thought you'd come in here and be like, what is this? And no, I see you're not protesting Florence Pugh's performance in this film.
No, honestly, I don't think I would have cut a minute of the film.
If anything,
I would have gone longer.
That storyline did not propel it forward whatsoever. You could have completely cut that, and you wouldn't have been lacking anything.
No, but to know that his,
if unless it was to further talk about or illustrate his character, that you know, sort of behind the theorist, the theoretical physicist that people knew him to be,
right?
You know, this, I don't know, would you call him a womanizer? Is that going too far?
Well, I think he stopped short of that, but it was part of his character, and he did, you know, leave his wife and. So I think the history's correct.
But you could have implied that without completely meaningless. And there's a scene, again, spoiler alert here, because there's a scene where her character isn't in it, let's just say, for the whole duration. Is that a way?
That's just a
spoiler
way
alert,
to put
but
it.
I'm also trying to be protective of it.
Right.
And that was very confusing because in a flashback, or it's like a flashback sequence that Oppenheimer is having, and Emily Blunt, his wife Kitty, comes to console him, and he's basically just found out that, well, I'm going to give it out now, so turn the channel and come back if you haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Is Jean, played by Florence Pugh, ends up committing suicide. But they make it seem in that flashback, did I not see a hand in a glove putting her down? Like, because she apparently drowns herself in a bathtub.
No, I think, you know, I saw it opening weekend. That?
Yeah, it's been a while.
And I vaguely, that's in my head. I can see it, what you're saying, but I don't remember it enough.
She gets on her knees and basically she takes some pills, and then she gets on her knees and puts her head underwater.
And a couple of times she comes into play because she calls him and says, I need you. And he stops everything and goes to help her.
He
and
sure
his
does.
Wife is like, what are you doing? And he's like, she needs me. What can I do?
Yeah.
She needs me.
Talk about, tell the listeners about this security hearing committee, whatever that's going on, the sort of, you know, B story, if you will.
Right, because the story is actually told a lot by Robert Downey Jr.
So, and did you notice, I didn't know this, we looked into this after the fact as well, because we were trying to determine the use, but the perspective from Robert Downey Jr. is all in black and white.
Yes.
So if that, so if you're not, if you didn't pick up on that when you watched the film, like I didn't at the beginning, that's really just to emphasize this is through his,
correct,
from his perspective.
And it also flips the time a little bit, although, you know.
See, originally I thought that was the device that Nolan was using, but it wasn't.
No.
In his own words, it was to just differentiate,
correct,
between this is his perspective. So
because the story's told by Robert Downey Jr. talking to his aide. Mm-hmm. And also it's told first person by Oppenheimer when he's talking to the committee and answering questions and basically laying out the story.
And what is the committee you're talking about?
I forget what they were called.
Well, he was accused of being a communist.
Correct.
Right? This is at a time in history when, you know, you had the McCarthy hearings going on. And
in fact, McCarthy was the district attorney at the time. Mm-hmm. So he was on this witch hunt,
right,
to use a phrase that we hear too much. He was on a witch hunt to get these communists, people who were meeting to discuss the work of Karl Marx. Then that makes me and you a communist because we've done that.
Left-wing sympathizers and all of this.
Correct.
You know? And if you're cavorting with the Russians and any hint of that.
Right.
And so he was under the microscope of this hearing. But it turns out, the reason I'm getting into this part of the story is, if you think back to the trailer, there's a part in the trailer where you hear Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer say, is anyone here going to tell the truth about what's going on around here or something mm-hmm. like that, right? Mm-hmm. And you think he's referring to the development of the atomic bomb and what they're going to be used for ultimately. And you can speak again about your time in Japan. We'll get to that. Mm-hmm. But he's really talking about the committee, that
correct,
this whole thing's a farce.
And it was a farce laid out by Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr.
That's
was behind the scenes pulling all the strings.
That's right. Which eventually got Oppenheimer's security clearance pulled.
Correct.
Which is true. And he no longer had access to any of the atomic,
right,
you know, the nuclear sort of records, secrets, whatever.
Strauss is what the Godfather would say, a passanavante.
Mike loves that phrase.
Yeah. I love that phrase. Yeah. But in the story by Oppenheimer, he had plenty of witnesses come forward and say he's not a communist. His mm-hmm. wife was more involved with it. He never signed, because you actually used to be able to sign up and you would get like a communist card.
Right.
And his wife did all that. So mm-hmm. I think part of the Florence Pugh aspect was kind of cleansing himself of the baggage that Emily Blunt had.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whether or not that's going too far, I don't know.
Yeah. It was interesting relationship. I mean, she had issues with the bottle.
Right.
You know, and
issues with raising kids.
Yes. Correct. I mean, they literally, at one point, Oppenheimer brings their first child, Peter, to like their friend Chevalier.
Right.
You know, who was like a French literature professor or something at Berkeley. And
can you take this?
Can you take the kids?
Yeah. And it was almost like, can you take this piece of merchandise off my hands?
For a little while. Yeah, that was interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. And all Oppenheimer was after with Strauss was to get a meeting with the president mm-hmm. to say, we don't have to use this weapon. The mere fact that we can show it exists is enough to sit down and talk.
And we saw where the president, Truman at the time, was landing on the issue. Because
correct. Get that whiner out of here.
Don't let that crybaby back into my office.
Correct.
Meaning Oppenheimer.
Yes.
Because he was trying to advocate for... It's interesting because do you think Oppenheimer, again, in how he's portrayed in the mm-hmm. film, do you think he was as conflicted as they were trying to make it out to be?
Yeah, because I'll tell you what, a week before the movie came out, MSNBC mm-hmm. did a 2-hour Oppenheimer special. You can get it on DVD now.
Nice.
And I watched that before I watched the movie. So I had a lot of the history in my head going in, and he was conflicted like that. Mm. He says a lot of the stuff that Cillian Murphy says in the movie is right out of Oppenheimer's mouth.
Yeah, and I think he was really kind of rolling the dice on the fact that just the mere presence of this thing.
Correct.
Just the fact that we have this technology.
We just need to tell them and show them the tests.
As soon as the test, the military, boom, load two up in the truck, let's head to Japan, you know.
Exactly.
And that was
And watching him watch the bombs leave his presence,
yes,
it's like he lost control. at that
right.
point.
Yeah. It's interesting. And you know what it makes me think of is a line that was reiterated often throughout the film, which is theory can only take you so far.
Yes.
You know, and then ultimately, so.
And the fear was when they were doing that test was because of nuclear fission and whatnot, that it was just going to keep going. Like when a earthquake has aftershocks, you've probably never experienced that. I have.
I have.
Have you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So
in Maryland, you know, believe it or not.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
It caused damage to the Washington Monument that they had a scaffold.
Oh, I didn't remember
months
that.
And months. Yeah. All right. Now, Mike, I'm going to ask you to put on your film hat, your professor hat. Okay. We don't go down this rabbit hole a lot, but I'm going to need you to talk a little bit about forced perspective and how Nolan created this, because this is not CGI, folks.
Correct.
This is, you know, camera tricks, perhaps, for lack of a better way to put it.
I'm dying to get the 4K for this.
Yeah.
Just to see how they did some of it.
But you would think he plucked the video, the actual test, and just kind of inserted it into the film. You wouldn't know the difference.
And forced perspective is when something's flat, you know, see it up close, it
makes looks bigger, smaller, even. You know.
And that's clearly what he did. These were little explosions that he made look bigger.
Yeah.
By placing the camera a certain way.
It was really phenomenal because most people, I think, understandably so, would just assume, oh, it's CGI.
Right.
But then when you read and you read about how one of his head people in the special effects and that whole department and how they created this was is really using more old school techniques than anything.
It is. Like, you know? In some cases, it was lighting a match and just watching the head of the match go.
Right. I do like what Nolan did when that climax arrives in the film of the test, the countdown, complete silence.
Right.
And all you hear is Oppenheimer's breathing.
Correct.
Really, while he's witnessing it, you know, behind a, whatever they built a shack.
A fence.
Yeah. Was he? I mean, through a little peephole.
Yeah. Think about that. They had goggles. There was one guy that had all the, you know.
Right.
The stuff on his face.
Right.
Yeah. But they're all just there with goggles. The military people just laid down on mattresses that were like, you know, they didn't even cover themselves.
Yeah. Right. Like, okay, don't turn around until we tell you to.
Right. And it's in the news.
They had the glass that they looked through.
Just this week or last week in the news, the fallout from those experiments has affected so many people in Nevada.
Sure.
But they were never covered. A lot of them are Native American people that, you know, we don't care about them, you know, so what? And,
just be clear.
What's that?
Because people don't read our sarcasm that you're not being serious when you say
Oh, no, I know.
God forbid, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We do get sarcastic on this
show. We get letters. Yeah.
So, you know, it took care of, there was a fund to take care of the fallout for three states, but it didn't include Nevada.
Hmm.
And a lot of people were upwind of the explosion. So it's just on the news, you know, all these people who had cancer in their family, likely because of that test.
Yeah.
Or tests.
Which, ironically, Oppenheimer, you know, he succumbed to throat cancer because he was, as you can see in the film, he's a chain smoker.
Right.
Almost every photograph you see of the guy, he's got a cigarette in his hand.
And a pipe. The pipe is the thing that I think Cillian Murphy got, like the mannerisms, the hands on the hips all the time.
And he didn't, in an interview from Cillian that I saw, he didn't really seem to do a very deep dive. He did enough just to grab the essence.
Right.
The rest is all him, which is amazing.
And the reason he did that was he didn't want to do an impersonation.
Right.
He wanted to play a character that had all these issues, but he stole just enough mannerisms to nail it.
It was really something to see. And to see this again, I have to say, to see it in IMAX.
Yeah.
And for an actor, I remember Robert Downey Jr. talking about this in a roundtable discussion they had. Damon was there, Emily Blunt. They were being interviewed for the movie before the strike and everything. And
yeah.
He just said what a marvelous job that Murphy did, of course, to be that exposed, that vulnerable, like the camera was basically in his face the whole movie.
Just yeah, all a lot of one and two shots.
Very
close up where, remember when the new Batman came out, I was like, why didn't they film the car chase the way Nolan did from above?
Mm-hmm.
And this, he totally goes against his normal, you know, of course it's hearings and you want to get in and see the sweat on people. And,
right. His the building of tension throughout the film.
Oh, it was unreal.
Leading up to that, the test was just.
Now, you were really tired when you went. You had a long couple of days. Mm-hmm. And going into a 3-hour movie, I might have been like, I'm going to fall asleep. Or this one kept me on edge.
Oh, yeah.
For
yeah.
3 hours. Like I said, I wouldn't have cut a frame.
Yeah, I didn't walk out going, you know, but it did seem like. Because that is the climax, right? Is that part. But of course, you have to continue to tell the story of what occurred in Japan. And
right. And that, you know, that's not told.
Right.
In fact, it ends with him getting an award and kind of getting
I mean, it's told a little bit. It's not
a little bit.
In fact, there's a scene where he's in some room and I don't know what was going on, but they're clearly seeing footage mm-hmm. of the aftermath Correct. Of the bombings. And this, again, brilliant by Nolan, right? We don't need to see.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us have seen those images anyways in our life right. and through history. We don't need to see it. It's implied, and that is powerful enough, especially because of the way Killian is acting and reacting to it.
Yeah, he uses reaction shots
right.
in a way that make you know what he's looking at.
And he really did play with sound quite a bit throughout the film. In fact, speaking of sound, the score,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw that in the credits, Ludwig Göransson, who did the score for The Mandalorian.
Oh, okay.
Didn't catch that. This guy's in a league all by himself. So
now, I want to talk about, because you brought it up earlier, because I've been there, and I've been to Hawaii.
Yeah, you mentioned it when we did the first look.
I think I did, and having been to both places, and I forget which order. I think I went to Hiroshima first,
mm-hmm.
but I've also been to Honolulu and the USS Arizona and how, you know, those bodies are still there. It really grips you when you watch, you see the bottom of the boat and you know the bodies are still in there because they couldn't get them cut out or whatever, and it got to the point where they said, let's just make this their grave, which I don't know if I was a family member, if I would have been thrilled about that. But having seen Pearl Harbor and then having been to the Peace Park, which is a section in Hiroshima that is left, you can look in history books and you see this picture, and to be in that spot walking around and these bombed out. I mean, they leveled Hiroshima. And now right outside the Peace Park, you would think you're in New York City. It's all rebuilt. I mean, the Japanese rebuilt amazingly fast. Yeah. I was there in what, 94, something like that. I was amazed. And what we did is I was with these two girls and we wandered away from the group. And we went to the city and kind of.
Did you hear that, folks? Mike was with these two girls and they wandered away from the group.
No, they were much younger than I was. Yeah. And
call the local authorities, folks.
Not at all, you know, attracted to an old guy like me. But we're walking around. And as we got further from where people visit, the reactions to us became like we would see elderly people and they would look at us, notice that we were European or American, and they would kind of like, we got some scowls. It got to the point where I got a little bit afraid of, we kind of got lost.
It's amazing the relationship we have with Japan, if you think about it. I mean, you know, recalling the events, it's kind of fascinating.
And it was Truman overreacting, clearly. I mean, Yeah, they killed, 1,000 people on Pearl Harbor attack, and there needed to be a response. But to wipe out, and when you go through the Peace Park, right, you wear these headphones, Mm-hmm. And you'll see like a bicycle all melted or mm-hmm. a tricycle all melted. And it'll have a picture of, this is Timmy Jones.
It tells you the story. Yeah.
Right. And he was riding his tricycle and the remains are all there. It's mm-hmm. like, it's devastating to see that site and how we leveled it.
Yeah. Do you
think Nagasaki as well, you know,
And maybe to your point, not having gotten into that side of the story, I don't know. Do you walk away with an understanding or a feeling of the monumental nature of what took place and what?
You can't help it. And really, I found myself more on the Japanese side of things than the American side. Like I said, it was an overreaction.
Well, it was interesting, the scene where they're basically, you know, with the heads of the military, they're in the room and Oppenheimer's there and they're basically talking about the number of casualties that they know that they're going to inflict.
Correct.
Right?
And it was 100 times what
they
inflicted. Now, I'm not sympathizing or, you know, saying I'm not trying to diminish Pearl Harbor in any way. Mm-hmm. That was a devastating attack on our country, a day that will live in infamy, according to Truman. Mm-hmm. And he was right. But did that the response of using the first atomic bomb? I mean, it ended the war. So a lot of military people are going to defend it.
Yeah.
And wasn't I don't want to be.
Wasn't that Eisenhower that gave that speech?
Was it? Was
the
it
the infamy Ike? Speech? Yeah, I think you're ahead of the. I think you're.
Well, Truman dropped the bomb.
I'm getting my history from Disney, from the American Adventure.
Yeah, you may be right.
Which is true.
Because there was an election. You know, and the president gets elected in November, but doesn't take office till January.
Well, right. But we're also talking about, what was it, 1941 or something?
Versus, yeah, it was December 7th, obviously.
Right. So, yeah. But thank you to the American Adventure cast for helping us with the history. Now, you know, it's interesting. Well, not interesting, not surprising at all. But we always talk about the Rotten Tomatoes and the Metascore and all that. I don't know if you looked it up, but 88 for the Metascore.
Yeah.
93% from the critics on Rotten Tomatoes, 91% from the audience, which I don't know if you make any, you know, inferences from this or not, where Barbie's numbers are slightly lower than that.
No, I have the numbers the same. I would be right on
but
that
yet
93.
Barbie's, you know, well over $1 billion.
Correct. I mean, if you want to go by money.
Yeah. So more people saw Barbie.
Right.
But less people liked it.
Would you rate this movie below Barbie? I would.
Well, it's not a pitting them against each other.
It's hard to.
They're so different. But I certainly agree with the ratings.
Right.
And for Barbie, too. I thought that was fair.
Right.
I thought that was right. That's about right.
And my brain, an strong B for Barbie was good.
But you can't compare the two.
You can't put them head to head.
Not at all. No, that wouldn't even be fair.
Ridiculously different story.
And we enjoyed both films. And clearly, we enjoyed Oppenheimer. So, you know, I didn't know a lot about Oppenheimer. You know, I of course, was studying up as we were preparing to talk about it, but certainly after seeing the film. So I didn't want to go in either way with any sort of expectations or an influence. But I didn't expect to learn what I learned about his character and who he was outside of his, you know, being again this, you know, well-known physicist, you know, with the relationships and this incident that they portray in the film where he supposedly made an attempt to poison his tutor,
right?
With the apple,
right?
He put some cyanide in an apple. I mean,
and,
it really,
what is he throws it away
from a friend of his from back then that this
that's
really
right.
happened.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he picked it up to take a bite. Didn't he?
Well, Kenneth Branagh was in the scene.
Yes.
And he swipes it from him. And I forget what his excuse was.
I think he threw it
away. Oh, wormhole.
Yes.
It was a nice phrase. You know, say wormhole. Right. That was kind of funny. But
history is a little different. Mm. than the movie, especially the Einstein stuff.
Of course.
And he worked with Einstein, which they don't portray. They portray that he just passed him and said something.
And it was subtle, but which was brilliant, right? Because that's where they show that same scene from both Oppenheimer's viewpoint and Robert Downey Jr.'s viewpoint. And Einstein knew what was up from the beginning.
He knew from the jump.
He knew
he could have done it.
He could have done it.
And he basically, in the movie, the way they chose to portray it is he says to Oppenheimer, "This is your time.
Right.
Good luck. You know,
and you better get right with God."
Exactly.
Pretty much what he was telling him.
Exactly. Because Einstein certainly had the intellect to create what he created. I mean, there was a lot of people in the creation.
Sure. Yeah.
And the fact that Oppenheimer gets singled out as the father of the atomic bomb is kind of not really the case.
Right.
A lot of people were responsible.
Well, so what's your overall assessment here? What's
like I said, I'm right with Rotten Tomatoes. I can't believe I'm saying that, but 93 is like very I liked Robert Downey Jr. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you were a little skeptical of him.
No, I liked it. I just felt as though it was at one point it was like, is this his film? Like the story was as much about him as it was about Oppenheimer. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. I mean, I never knew of Strauss until the movie.
I didn't either.
And to see that he played such a big part behind the scenes of what was going on, like you said,
right.
He stopped and got him approval, you know, to, I mean, and then Oppenheimer built this town.
Yeah. And I had no idea that Han Solo was affiliated with the Trinity.
I thought his character was a reporter when I first watched
it. It was an aide.
But he was an aide.
Now, we didn't mention Rami Malek was in it. Not a big part.
Small part.
A significant part.
Yeah.
Like in a pivotal scene in the movie.
Yes.
But again, I didn't like it. I felt it was very contrived. It happened too quickly, the events that surrounded his performance in the, you know.
Right. Right.
That part of the storyline where he basically is the one that blows the lid off of Strauss's antics that he's up to. And I don't know. I wasn't into
that. And it looked like his aide took pleasure in Strauss getting.
It did. It was weird. It was a little tempered, but I think ultimately Aaron Reich's character was like enjoying that.
Yeah, enjoy life on the cabinet or whatever he said sarcastically.
Right.
To him, because his career went in the toilet.
Where do you put this up there with Nolan's work? And where do you put this? You know, of course, Killian's worked with Nolan more than once before. He was Scarecrow in the Dark Knight trilogy. He was in Inception. And
he was in a movie called Red Eye.
Nolan, though.
No, I think that's the first time I saw Cillian Murphy.
I think
he has these piercing blue eyes.
He really does, yeah.
That, you know, you look at him, you're like, remember the episode of Seinfeld, The Wiz? I'm The Wiz.
It's interesting you're bringing this up again, because you did profess your love for him in the first look. And I said, that's a whole nother first look that we're talking about when Mike laid eyes on Killian for the first time.
I'm telling you.
If he doesn't, I don't know what's with the strike and what's going to happen with award shows, and I don't really care, but as award shows go, if he isn't up for the top runner for best actor, I don't know what to tell you.
We haven't seen something better yet.
No. And again, I just can't imagine what would top this. It's just, wow. It's really,
and
it's
put it in Christopher Nolan's, who's got a resume to put against any director out there. This I would put on top. Probably Dark Knight number two.
Speaking of great directors, Gareth Edwards is coming into his own kind of league. And he was, of course, the guy that directed Rogue One, which is up there. It's my top two Star Wars films of all time.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw before Oppenheimer, one of the trailers was The Creator, which we also did a first look on. Mm-hmm. It's that one that he's got coming out. It's all about AI and AI taking over and whatever. Denzel Washington's son stars in it, because he was in Tenet with Nolan.
Yeah.
So he's been in both worlds, but the trailer in IMAX with that Aerosmith Dream On soundtrack over it is just, it gives me goosebumps, man. I can't wait to see it.
Imagine, yeah, I imagine seeing it in the theater here, because you know it was like the top five in five theaters.
I'm due for a trip. So
yeah, but Oppenheimer will be long gone.
It will. Yeah, but we
in
can
fact
see
it's already gone. I think.
No, it's still going strong here in IMAX. You know, it was pretty good crowd. It wasn't full by any stretch, but it was pretty good crowd.
Well, it's got legs,
and IMAX is not cheap, my friends.
Right.
It's
got legs because Oppenheimer continues to you know.
Well, maybe now people like me, everybody that's seen Barbie, okay, I've seen Barbie, now let me go see Oppenheimer.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you said, Oppenheimer's still kind of on a slow burn, but great job. Another fine piece by Nolan. And just, again, a spectacular performance by Cillian Murphy, and the supporting cast were all really, really good. Many other names we didn't mention, you know, you can look it up, but Tony Goldwyn, who was in Ghost, been around for years, was in it, had a great
thing to do is go see it.
If you
think you know the history, or if you do know the history, you'll have a couple of issues with it like I did, but as far as filmmaking goes, it doesn't get better. Just doesn't get better. I haven't seen a movie this good this year.
Yeah.
And I don't think I saw one that good last year.
And I think the chances of us not liking this were near zero, Mike.
Probably.
Near zero? How about zero would be good?
Yeah. Given the reaction we had to the first look and the history of it all.
Yeah.
This is one you got to see. Got to see it in the theater.
Yeah, hey, listen. All right, so listen, that's a review on Oppenheimer here with the O Brother podcast. If you're not currently following us, make sure that you do go out to our official website, which is ohbpodcast.com. Mike, we, of course, have that on our lovely mug. We're going to be debuting a new set of merchandise here coming up soon, perhaps, in one of our future episodes. It's not long before we start moving into our O Brother Halloween Fest.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a dive into some classic and some current horror films. Looking forward to that. We've been doing that for the last couple of years. And we've got coming up, too, an interview with director Bruce Wemple that we think you're going to love. That was a nice conversation we had with Bruce. So we were
really
glad for him to join us on the show. So that's coming out, too. I also want to give a shout out to a couple of fellow podcasters, Andrea and Alex of Fika Talk, F-I-K-A. Look it up, Google it. You'll learn what that means, that word. It's got Swedish origins, I'll say. But they're a couple of best friends. They've been best friends from literally since they're kids from the 90s. And they talk.
You can tell. You can tell by
the
way they talk. Just like people can tell we're real brothers because we want to reach through and
go at each other's
throat.
You know, and I got to say, I want to make it clear for the record, just in case our folks, friends at Fika Talk don't. If you listen to their episode, let's see, I got to get it right now, Mike. Hold on. Let's see. So Fika Talk, which you can get on your favorite podcast platform, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, they're everywhere. Let's see, Mike. Let's look at, I need to know, I want to be specific. Okay, if you listen to episode 30, okay, they were trying out some new microphones. These microphones, in fact, the Samson Q2U.
The very ones we use.
And from the moment I heard the first millisecond of that episode, I knew they were not using the mics. They might have been talking into them, but they weren't using them. I did recommend the mics to one of the hosts, Andrea. And so I said to her, make sure that I expect a clarification on your follow-up.
Because they gave us a shout-out when they weren't using the mic.
That's right. So it was not the greatest shout-out, let's be honest. They were shouting into nowhere.
People were probably like, why did they listen to them?
Right. Now, they've got a new episode out now called Arizona Limited Edition Part 1 because they had taken a break from their podcast for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So their listeners kind of have an interest now, like, hey, where you been? What took place in the last 2 years? So they're starting to release some episodes talking about that. So this new episode that they have out, man, does that mic sound nice and crisp and clean and clear? So they figured out the technical snafus, but just want to make it clear here at the O Brother podcast that we know what we're talking about over here.
We only recommend top-notch stuff.
especially when it comes to audio engineering. So, but yeah, give Fika Talk a shout. You know, give them a look, give them a subscription, and I think support
this
that show.
Was an episode of Fika Talk. It seems like
there's Fika Talk right there.
Yeah,
you got to show love for the fellow podcasters, absolutely. And I will expect that in return on episode 31 of the Fika Talk podcast. All right. Well, Mike, that's going to do it for our review of Oppenheimer. And we've got a lot, like I said, coming up next with Halloween Fest and this interview and others. But yeah, anything to say as we close it out here in the Oppenheimer episode?
No, I'm looking forward to the interview. I'm looking forward to getting into our Halloween mindset.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Because it's hot right now, so
yeah, we got some first looks coming at you. We're going to cover some horror films, so yeah, we got a lot coming in the next few months.
Yeah,
but that's going to do it for another episode of the O Brother Podcast. I'm your host Dan Smith, alongside me as always my brother from the same mother, Mike Smith, and we will see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Hi, everyone. This is Cindy Busby, and you're listening to the O Brother Podcast.